So this is March 21st, 2009, and this is a teleconference on the Patrick Lecture 160, which is Conciliation of Inner Split. Now, I found when I started doing the work for it that 159, the one just ahead, they're a paired lecture. And the guide even says that in the first paragraph. So I put that out as the, in the material supporting this, I put out the two, and I'm going to be talking about both, even though I centered on 160 in some of the newsletters that I put out. This lecture is not sexy. This lecture is not necessarily fun or easy to understand. It doesn't give a lot of juicy examples of how to, neither one of the lectures. So the concepts are very, very basic to Pathwork. And again, my goal here is to give you other dimensions with which you can work with the lectures. I'll give you an example of that in a few moments. But knowing that you can read the lecture, and if the lecture is appropriate for where you are doing your personal process work, then it will sing to you and make a lot of sense. What often happens is that we read a lecture and somehow we feel like we aren't getting it. And I'm going to illustrate a point in the lecture with that situation. So when we read a lecture and we just don't get it, or you can read paragraph after paragraph and somehow it's just not coming in, what the lecture is actually going into is the possibility that you've got a split in you, a push-pull, a place where your conscious mind is willing and eager to take in the information, but that without your realization, there's another part of you that's in resistance. So if you can imagine reading something that part of you wants to receive and the other part of you wants to push away. And reading something that you don't think offends you or upsets you, but just not being able to wrap your head around it, can sometimes be a way of finding a manifestation of a place where your conscious and unconscious mind are not in alignment. So when the guy talks about the unconscious mind, this is not inherently negative. There is not a presupposition, there is not a presumption that our unconscious minds are negative. In fact, there is an assumption that there is a positive intent throughout our being. The dilemma is that the unconscious forces are not in your awareness. Now, why does that matter? One of my favorite examples, which I repeat a lot, please forgive this, is that when science, when it was in its infancy, when we were coming out of the medieval ages and through the Renaissance, and the scientists were starting to look for laws and rules and facts instead of the equivalent of superstitions, wives' tales, and mythology or religious explanations for things. One of the more famous scientific experiments was when a gentleman was trying, there was a principle in science, and it was also in theology, and it was called spontaneous generation. And that theory put forward the fact that life simply happens. It simply comes on the scene fully formed. And during that time period, they thought that a baby entered the woman as a fully formed being and simply got bigger instead of going through developmental stages. So in this one experiment, they were trying to figure out where maggots came from. Now, to us, that's bizarre because we've had this in our knowledge base for so long. We know where insects come from. We know that there's a process. But imagine being in a time and place where they have never connected the dots between meat that starts to go bad and the appearance of maggots. So it was a simple experiment. The scientist put two pieces of meat in jars and left one open and put cheesecloth over the top of the other. Maggots appeared in the uncovered jar, but not in the jar with the cheesecloth on the top. And from that simple place, he began to observe more, and he observed flies landing on the meat. And the light struck that the maggots were possibly the larvae, and were the larvae, of course you can follow this, of the flies. But this is a very, very classic example of finally getting cause and effect clear. So if you can imagine for a moment, before that time, there were flies and there were maggots, and one day the maggots disappeared and there were more flies, and there was not a train of thought, there was not clear evidence from A to B to C. To some extent, that's what this lecture is talking about. If we have no awareness of the conscious forces that are moving inside us, then we will not be able to connect the dots between life manifestation that may conflict with our values or confuse us. We may think that this is, the lecture goes into, we have a propensity to blame. We have a tendency to blame other people for a problem. Because if we cannot see how we participated in a negative act, then we are looking around for other evidence. We're looking around for what could have created this negative act. And the invitation in these lectures is to consider the possibility that we are responsible for the energies that form around us. And as I've teased before, all the lectures are related. So this is a very good pairing with lecture 201, the demagnetization of negative force fields. That when we create an atmosphere of hatred or anger because there are forces in us that we are not aware of, that are angry and resentful, that we create a cloud of energy around us that invites others to join us, a nice community when we all feel the same way, and negative likes negative. And if you wonder, why am I always surrounded by bitter people? The lecture invites you to look inside. It invites you to look at the possibility that you may have some bitterness in you that you are simply not aware of. And because you aren't aware of it, you don't address it. And because you don't address it, it manifests. So it's a beautiful title to the Lecture 159, Life Manifestation in Expression of Dualistic Illusion. So it's very hard, of course, to, how do you know what your unconscious mind is thinking? How do you find out what's going on if you cannot be aware of it? Awareness is crucial. For this, our task is to use the equivalent of peripheral vision. So because we are manifesting it, if you do not know what you are putting out, look at what you are manifesting. Look at the evidence in your life. And one of the short phrases that we've made out of that, the common Patrick phrase, is your life does not lie. And by that, what is meant is that whatever happens in your life is not an accident or a coincidence or something that is being done to you, but that there is an organic relationship between what manifests in your life and what your soul holds. Now, in the last teleconference, the compulsion to recreate and overcome childhood hurts, I spoke about the fact that with pathwork and with other spiritual works, we don't go back to age 4, age 3, or the fact that you were not held when you were an infant. We go further back than that. So, in that belief system, and I invite you to try it on and just work with this material as if it's true and see if it has anything for you. If we work with that and we go back to preconception, if we go back to a spiritual place where we had input, we don't know how much, because we don't know how developed our souls are and how much participation we might have had, but if we go back to the place where decisions were made about the life that we're going to live, even our culture, our parents, our physical shape and size, all these are already manifestations of a spiritual reality. And we're not meant to be aware of it. We're not supposed to walk through life with a manual in our hand saying, do this, do that, do the other, and this is the whys and the wherefores. Part of life is to move through these events, these circumstances, and to learn from them. So again, bringing other lectures into this, the purpose of life on this earth, according to the Pathwork lectures, is to actually manifest our soul's distortions. Not to hide them, and not to show how wonderful we are. How wonderful we are is assumed. But we've come here to learn. We've come here with an idea that doesn't quite work. It doesn't fit spiritual law. And we bring in all the materials we need to manifest our point of view. And if it isn't aligned with spiritual law, it will result in negativity. That's the premise here. So the positive things in your life are coming from the same place as the things coming from you that manifest in negative ways. The negativity is not meant as a punishment for you. It's meant as evidence that there are forces in you or beliefs in you that are not in alignment with spiritual law. So again, if you work from the premise that your life does not lie, it's a way of changing your attitude a little bit so that when you have a negative situation in front of you, you might consider looking at it with a more positive viewpoint and say, what is this? What is possible here? What does this show me that I may not have seen before? And in that way, we take responsibility, some responsibility for what is going on. We take a positive attitude towards what's in front of us, which will help us in trying to figure things out, where the negative attitude is it's a pull away, it's a withdrawal from that. And by holding on to our divine, by really connecting into our higher self with this work, we touch the place where we know we've come here to learn, even though we may find the learning uncomfortable or unpleasant. Now, I want to go back for a moment to the question, how do you find unconsciousness in your life? And I found two interesting examples that I'd like to invite you to play with. They're very simple. I invite you to do this while I'm talking about it. One of the places where we get in trouble is we really believe our brain. Now, why would you get in trouble? Because the brain is only a mechanism. It doesn't hold the entire truth. It is not the be-all and end-all of the universal reality. It is only our mind. So when the brain is telling us things and we believe it without thinking, we allow the brain to set the stage. We allow the paradigms of the brain to be the primary interpreter of the situation. Now that sounds very conceptual and theoretical, but I'm going to show you a little way to see that. What I'm going to invite you to do is to cover one eye with your hand and take a finger on the other hand and very gently push on your eyeball. Obviously very gently. Don't do this if you're driving and listening to this tape. But just push gently on the corner of your eye until there's a distortion in what you see. I'm going to take a breath for a second and let you try that. So what you're doing is you're changing the shape of the eye and distorting it so that it looks like the room goes cockeyed for a second. Now, when you do that, and you might want to do it two or three times as I talk through this. When you do that, if you listen to what your brain says, your brain says the room moved. The brain does not say, ooh, that's the eyeball squishing. The brain's perception is that something has changed. And the reason for that, and what I'm describing here, is one example of how the brain thinks and the paradigms it uses. The brain, it never occurs to the brain that your eye is being affected by something. And the brain is basing this assumption on the fact that eyes are buried deep in our head and very, very seldom, unless you are doing something deliberately, such as touching the corner of the eye with your finger, is the eye distorted. So the brain comes to rely upon the images that the eye sees to give it information. So when you close one eye and look with the other, and distort the shape of the eye so that the room twitches, there is some portion of your brain that thinks the room moved. Now, I know that that's a very tiny example, but a lot of the work that we do on spirituality is, relatively speaking, small, petty, tiny, minute details where we have made assumptions in our life that are not valid. So that's an example of where the brain has a basis for making decisions that is right 99.99% of the time, but doesn't include the one time when you fool with your own eye. So the brain is a wonderful tool, works well, catches a lot of things, but it's still working from paradigms. Now, hoping that you still want to play a little bit with me, I have another one for you. Again, don't do this if you're driving, because we could get in trouble. But I got this through one of those terrible email forwards, and sometimes they're actually useful. I hate to admit it, because people send me more, but sometimes they're useful. And this little trick was discovered by a neurologist. Don't know the gentleman's name, would love to give him credit. And what it involves is putting one leg, your right leg, seems to be important that it's the right leg. Putting the right leg forward and using your toe and moving at the ankle, making clockwise circles with your right foot. And then taking your left hand index finger and in the air in front of you, writing the letter 6. Now you may not be able to do this exercise while you're listening to me because it's a little bit of pat your head and rub your tummy. But if you try it later on, you'll find that your foot changes direction. Now, I don't know what this means to the neurologist, and I wish I knew more. I love reading things like this and finding out their history, but this is all I've got. And you can decide all you want that you're going to keep that foot moving clockwise, but it won't. And this impressed me perhaps more than other silly games like this, because it was brought forward by a neurologist, and I would guess that there's some neurological thing going on that between the right foot and the left hand, you can't tell the wiring, no, don't do that. Now, I bring that up because it is difficult for a grown adult to believe that they cannot control how their foot moves. And yet, apparently, there's some hardwiring connection in our body that, he doesn't say that no one can, but that's the implication, that this is hardwired, that hardly anyone, I'll use that, can stop their foot from reversing. If you do not have incontrovertible evidence like that, I hope you can see where you might decide to interpret things differently than what may be actually happening. In other words, life is not as simple as a neurological experiment. When you press on your eye, if you're not careful, your brain can say, oh, I know this trick, You can't fool me. I'll agree that the eye is moving. You may have to do it several times before you realize that the first feeling is that the room is moving. And then the realization comes, oh, that's because I'm moving my eye. And when we're talking about self-analysis of unconscious behavior patterns, this may be the level of detail that you need to work with. I find that exciting. I find it exciting because it is there. The evidence is going to come forward. And the work is only to become aware of discrepancies, to become aware that we didn't mean that, but we did anyway, to bring the facts in and to look at them, and we can become aware of unconscious forces. Now, I wanted to give two cute examples because I'm going to go a little bit further, and it may not be as easy for you to see these examples as it is for you to see a simple trick of the body. Another example of how we might be able to become aware of unconscious forces is when emotions and feelings come bubbling out of us that surprise us. Now, because they're unconscious, we may not see them. And so what very commonly happens is a friend, or a non-friend, but someone, gives us feedback. And they say the equivalent of, why are you angry? And you say, I'm not angry. Well, this is where it gets tricky. When someone says, why are you angry? The invitation here is to not brush them off and say, I was not consciously angry, and therefore the comment is irrelevant. The invitation here is to notice that whatever you did gave an impression of anger that prompted someone to give you feedback. Because if you were angry and it looked like you knew you were angry, saying you're angry is redundant. Who would do that? So usually when people give us feedback, especially quiet, thoughtful feedback, they are giving us feedback because they are suspicious that we may not have awareness of emotions that we are expressing, especially if they're just peripheral to what we're doing. We think we're simply explaining, and we don't realize the anger that has crept into that. But someone else might notice the anger and bring it to our attention. And this is what the guide means when he says that you're not meant to do this work alone. That having other people in your life, having friends, having associates, having spiritual groups, religious groups, theosophical groups, in having a therapist to give you feedback, in having relationships to give you feedback, this is how we have the ability to become aware of forces inside us that otherwise might remain invisible for a longer period of time. Surely you would become aware eventually. But the other aspect of this work is you might do a lot of things eventually. Working on spiritual self-analysis, going along a spiritual path, is to some extent the expression of a desire to accelerate your process, to become more conscious of what you're doing, so that you can do it with more enthusiasm and gain more positive results. So if this is your goal, to accelerate your process, the feedback that other people give you, that's fuel that will enable you to see things that you may not be quite ready to see, but you can accelerate that readiness. Now, are they completely right? No. Sometimes someone can see anger where there isn't anger. There might be impatience. There might be something else. So when someone gives you feedback, the trick is to try to find out what made them think you were angry. So if they're very, very sensitive to anger, they might think that any sharpness or gruffness is anger. And you may be able to say, no, I wasn't angry. But isn't that interesting that you were gruff or short? Or that there was an anxiety that you may not have been fully aware of? So all feedback isn't necessarily going to change your opinion of who you are and what you're doing. But it is information. So again, the process of becoming more aware of our unconsciousness is to use the evidence at hand. Part of the evidence is what we have manifested in our life. Part of the evidence is feedback that we get from other people, even though it is crusted up with their own stuff and their own opinion and their own values. There's still possibly something in there for you. You may have to work hard to find the grain of truth. But it's a grain of truth, and it may well be worth the effort it takes to find it. So there's one more example of unconsciousness that I found, and I honestly couldn't figure out how to integrate it seamlessly into this, so I'm just going to plop it in now. Being a movie fan, there's a wonderful science fiction movie from the 50s called The Forbidden Planet. And it gives a lovely story quality to a discussion of the unconscious. And very briefly, the premise is that there was an alien world and there were very, very advanced beings, and they were called the Krell. And they invented fabulous machinery that at some point would do what their thoughts told it to do. And then a bunch of colonists from the Earth arrive, and they find that there are no Krell, but that there are these machines. But they are also wiped out over a period of time, leaving two survivors. So then the third wave comes in, the third ship, or the second ship from Earth. And what manifests in the movie is that the Krell never thought about the fact that the machines could not delineate between their conscious and their unconscious thought patterns, so that they were destroyed when their primitive emotions were stirred. And they didn't realize what was happening because they were not aware of their own inner negativities. And once again, I'm not putting a value judgment on this, but destruction tends to be negative. So when you say, I hate you, I want you dead, it's not that we intend to do that, but on a gut level, we can have a burst of emotion like that. If that burst of emotion set a piece of machinery in action that killed the other party, we might not be able to connect back to our thought pattern, especially if it's deeply repressed. And we may not realize that the machine that makes our coffee at 8 o'clock in the morning the way we ask for it to be done in our thought is also killing our neighbors. So the movie was a lovely way of fleshing out the idea that when we agree to put all our thoughts forward to be manifested, we need to be aware of what we've done. And that's what we do in life. We put forward, all of us, the positive and the negative, the consciousness and stuff that we're not aware of. So the lecture invites us to search for, to become aware of, and to embrace all of who we are. And the statement in the lecture is that the separation between your conscious and unconscious mind is your greatest enemy. It isn't what's down in there. It isn't your negative thoughts. It isn't your lack of development. It isn't the forcing currents that you feel. It's the fact that you don't own them. You do not govern them unless you know them. So that's where 160 picks up. And 160 picks up on the idea that part of our work is to integrate to the conciliation of inner split. And as part of that, the lecture invites us not to be afraid of who we are. This is a point that I think, I know it's in every single lecture, but sometimes it's very subtle and it's not picked up on. The idea that there is nothing wrong with us is a very difficult thing for human beings to accept. And there's a reason for that. All our lives, we've all our lives, the primary feedback you get is don't do that. Get away from that, don't do that, you're in my way, you did it wrong. It tends to prompt a lot of conversation. We don't go around the world glad-handing each other in the back and saying, atta girl, great job, not 24/7. A lot of the human communication is about what went wrong. And without realizing it, and this is where, when we talk about paradigms are basic beliefs that go underground like an aquifer. And yet, they run our lives. And the concept of paradigm is that they're not beliefs that are on the surface that can be examined on a regular basis. They've gone so far underground we're not aware that they're running us. Like the machines in the background that do whatever we think, we're not aware of the mechanism. So one of the paradigms many, many people carry in life is not good enough. And I like using the word spiritual practice because it does take practice to pull out these paradigms and to work with them and begin the process of shifting them. It's not easy to hold what is an adult level of confusion. You know, kids don't hold this. That's why they come up with value systems and paradigms and simplistic solutions, and they start building their lives on them. Because all this complexity can be very, very hard. But as adults, it's important for us to get a grasp on the fact that it's very complicated. I can be a basically good person and very, very capable of doing terrible things by not realizing the implications of my actions, by not realizing my self-interest, by not constantly reminding myself what am I doing for everybody versus what am I doing only for me or my family or my town or my village. Anytime there is a duality expressed, them and me, and I vote for me instead of trying to see a larger picture, then there's a possibility there that in my narrow-mindedness, I can do things that are not good long-term for all of us. And this would be a spiritual explanation for why good people can do terrible things. To some degree, they simply become myopic. It is not my experience that people want to create harm. It is my experience that they are actually trying to prevent harm. But when in trying to prevent harm, we create even more dualities. This is a little bit better than that, which is a little bit worse than that. The dualities are the problem. So this goes back to what the lecture said, that the separation between your conscious and unconscious mind is your greatest enemy. So in conciliating the split, when we're putting it together, one of the things that we need to look at is a tendency to blame. Now, I'm going to have to back up for a second because I leapt onto blame without picking up responsibility. One of the pleasures that I had in studying pathwork was, and this happens, I think, sometimes when you come into a certain kind of work after crisis. Before crisis, you think your life works and why should I change it? But in crisis, change is good. I need something new. And you're more willing to take a different perspective. So coming into Pathwork after crisis, Pathwork basically told me that my life was my responsibility. Well, my life was not in good shape. But what I was able to absorb that gave me enthusiasm and a desire to continue in the work was, if my life was not my responsibility, then what could I do about it? Let me give you that again. If I'm not responsible, then someone else is responsible for my life. And if I don't like it, I have to get the other person to do something about it. That's a lot of work. And it's not normally too successful. But the hook they set in me that went in quite easily at that time was that if I am responsible, then whatever I have in front of me as my life, I can change. If I created this mess, then I can uncreate it. If I'm responsible for bringing something into my life, then I can take responsibility for moving it out of the... If I am responsible for bringing something into my life, then I can be responsible for either moving it out of my life or moving myself into a new situation. So let me repeat that, because the cough interrupted it. If you are responsible for the negativity in my life, then I have to get you to fix it. If I am responsible for the negativity in my life, I have the power to change it. I find that an empowering statement to make. It does require that I take responsibility for what I have done. And each individual has a different level of responsibility. And mixing these two lectures together, it's very, very important to be charitable and understanding that we may not understand how we created this, especially if the point of creation goes back before this lifetime and we created circumstances because it was best for our spirit. From an individual point of view, from the very tiny energetic place of only being a human being instead of a great spirit, we may find it very, very difficult to deal with the negativities in our life. The lecture is encouraging us to reach out and embrace this as best we can. This is not a statement of "it's your fault." In saying it's our responsibility, we're simply putting the empowerment back into our own hands. In saying that it is our responsibility, that does not mean we did it to ourselves. The new question it asks is, why? Why did that experience get invited into my life, and what can come from it? So it's just a different perspective and an encouragement of a different attitude towards unconscious behavior, negative aspects in your life. A change of attitude can sometimes be the only thing you need to change your life. So going from taking responsibility, not fault, but responsibility for what's in your life. This is where the propensity to blame other people gets in the way. Because if it's your fault, that's just another way of saying it's your responsibility. Now, it may be that the other person has done a great deal to create the problem, but we can't necessarily address their life task and their dynamics and their force, and there's a lot of stuff going on in that other person that we may not be able to address. The invitation is to look at what I can address. How did I contribute? Where is my empowerment? If I take responsibility for what is present in the moment, what is possible? What can I do? So instead of assigning blame to the situation, you may need to evaluate the situation. You may need to be very objective and very clear about how this mess happened. But that's quite different from trying to apportion blame. Let me see if I can give it a different spin. For the past 6 months, which I think everybody can understand, I keep having politics want to come into these teleconferences for two reasons. One is that I don't have anybody in the room with me, and I'm not inviting you to undergo personal process, intimate personal process here, because it's a little bit too revealing and may not be something you want to do. So I try to find more objective examples of the principle, and that's where I keep running into politics and finance, because it is a global situation, the financial stuff. So here's my invitation as an example of this lecture in the financial crisis that we all experience, even if we're not wounded by it. We have an experience of this. And another way of looking at it, one way of looking at it is, those guys did it. Those rich people, assigning blame and responsibility to our government, to bankers, to financiers, to easy credit, to housing booms, to greed, to people's greed, to people's lack of responsibility in taking on financial obligations that they could not hold up on. Those may all be true. What Packwick invites us to do is to consider, what does that mean to me now? If I am part of all of us, then I carry a part of this. I don't know how big. I don't know exactly what I did. And in the real world, I may not have done very much. But I tell you personally that I have looked at my life very, very closely because I spend a lot of my time being a Packwick helper. And the first thing I have to do is look at me before I point fingers at anyone else, if I ever point fingers at anyone else. And when I look at the situation and I ask myself, where were you, Jan? What were you doing? Tell me all the good things you were doing that have nothing to do with this financial mess. And without going into detail, I found places where I participated in the financial meltdown. Now, my contribution is very small. I'm not a big player in this. But the important thing was for me to find the place where I became greedy. I wanted my peace. I didn't campaign for stronger laws. I tried to find a better broker. Okay? I wanted to get my slice of this growing economy and these wonderful stocks, and I wanted to join in this feeding frenzy. I didn't put brakes on. I didn't put my money under the mattress. Okay? It may be a very small portion of this, but what I'm emphasizing here is it's not a matter of how big your level of responsibility is. The question is, are you willing to see it? Are you even willing to look for it? What is your part? If we are all members of society, there is some place where we cooperate with society. And 98% of that can be positive. That's not the issue here. Congratulations. You know, you give to charity, you give volunteer time, you're kind to your children, you raise children into responsible adults, you pay your taxes, you keep your property clean, you vote on time. All these are wonderful, positive things. And like I tell my clients, we don't look at all the positive things you've done, except if you need a little shoring up of your ego and you're feeling a little shaky about, I'm a bad person. No, you're not a bad person. But when I work with people, I work with that one place where they're not in integrity, where they didn't do the right thing, where they were unconscious of conflicting forces in them, and they're not taking responsibility for something that is something they could have taken responsibility for. This is the same attitude that I have looked at, that's what I'm describing here, is in society at large, I tried to find my peace. The place where before I blame other people, what would I have done in that situation, and what did I do with the small piece of input I did have into the financial situation? I hope that's not a little esoteric, but what I'm trying to describe is that the work is finding your part, your responsibility. And when you see where you may have also taken a similar attitude with your $100, perhaps it is easier to understand where someone did something even grander with their $10 million. And in that place, it's not that we're excusing them, and it's not that we're condemning ourselves. But what this does is it shifts our attitude, and it can give us a sense of us. Okay, we all thought that there would be no end to the boom. We all wanted this to rise. And now we're all going to have to change our minds. Again, hoping that I'm not getting too esoteric, is a place where I decided that I was finger-pointing, I could feel it, and so I deliberately turned the finger around at me and said, okay, what are you doing day-to-day different now? You've seen the larger version of this catastrophe. Now let's bring it home. Let's look around the house. Where is your energy expenditure? What are you doing that you could do differently to change this one household? So before you point at those people, take a look at your own home. Now there's a place where you can say, but I recycle, but I this, but I that. But there's always something that we can do on an individual basis. Imagine if every single person on the planet did the equivalent of an energy, what do they call them, an energy audit of their own life and trim things down by 10 or 20%. The trick is that that involves some change and some compromise, and when we feel that the other person is not doing their share, we use that as an excuse to not do what we can do. Now, we've gotten a little bit far afield, but that's what these lectures are talking about. I'm going to repeat the titles. Life Manifestation is Expression of Dualistic Illusion and the Conciliation of Inner Split. And while these are, of course, spiritual principles, what I'm saying is if you flesh them out and you put clothes on them and you put actual situations on them, that's where it becomes real to you. That's where it became real for me, that there were places where I was blaming, where I wasn't taking full responsibility, not for the world catastrophe, but for what I can do today. And by taking a different attitude, what I can do tomorrow and the next week. I'm going to take a break right now, and I'm going to change some tapes. And when we come back, bear with me for just a second, we'll take some questions if you have them. I'm very happy to do that. So just one moment, please.